Hey, welcome along. that wasn't a great start. That made me look. We got a few technical issues, and we got a few human issues today. But it's 6 minutes past four Eastern time in North America. That's 6 minutes past four, five in the Maritimes, 5:36 in Newfoundland, and 6:06 p.m. in beautiful Saint-Pierre-Miquelon and Langlade, and 9 p.m. in London, 10 p.m. in Paris, wherever you are on this Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening, or Wednesday morning. Welcome along to our live Clubland Q&A. As you can see from that coughing fit, I'm not in great shape, and evidently our theme music has keeled over and died entirely too. But this is our Clubland Q&A. I hit the ground running. I came back to the United States last Sunday, and I did a full week of guest hosting at Fox News, a little bit of Rush, a limbo or two, and somewhere along the way, it was a broiling week in New York City and air conditioning everywhere, and I caught this dreaded lurgy. So if my voice totally gives out, we're going to go for a track from Feline Groovy, and then I'll have some Hall's mentholyptus-type lozenge and come back. And if it happens again, I don't think we'll play a second track from Feline Groovy. I'd like a happy song. I'm in the mood for a happy song. You know, 1920s, they had the happiest songs. When the Red Red Robin comes bob, bob, bobbing along. Nobody writes songs about Red Red Robins bob, bob, bobbing anymore. Anyway, we'll have a happy song from there. We'll have Al Jolson singing When the Red Red Robin Comes Bob, Bob, Bobbing Along. Mammy! But my voice isn't in great shape, but I'm going to try and take some of your... By the way, if you want to actually get whatever it is that I've got... I got it from New York. I think I got it on the subway. It's tuberculosis or something like that. But if you'd like to catch tuberculosis from me, you can come on the Mark Stein cruise, and I'll give it to you personally. Throw it in free of charge. We're going to be sailing at the end of next month, height of fall foliage season, from Montreal. We're going to go out the St. Lawrence. We're going to go to Quebec City, Prince Edward Island, down the beautiful eastern seaboard of New England, Maine. We'll pass the beautiful New Hampshire seacoast. That'll take all of 3 minutes, just a little bit of it, and eventually dock in Boston. And if you'd like to come on the cruise, a lot of the things that we do at Stein Online, including this, we're going to be doing live and at sea. So if you'd like to come on, you can book your staterooms, you can book your cabin, you can travel steerage. It's up to you. But if you just go to Stein Online, you'll see our little cruise club banner, and we look forward to that. Okay, we started a bit late, and we'll run a bit late, because we don't have the theme music, as I said, we might have Al Jolson doing When the Red Red Robin Comes Bob Bob Bobbing Along. We'll see. But we're here to talk about whatever you want to talk about, because I've been away, and this is our first Clubland Q&A since I got back. It's a fairly typical day. 80 cars torched mysteriously in Sweden. Nobody thought about torching cars. If you've ever driven a Volvo, there are times when you've wanted to torch it. But otherwise, Sweden was not a land that was associated with nightly carbecues, as they're known in France. I think it was my Aussie friend Tim Blair who coined that term. And in Gothenburg and Malmo and Stockholm, they had mysteriously, and the Prime Minister is all upset about it. Okay, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about all this multicultural car burning you now have in Sweden? Sweden, the hottest thing in Sweden used to be Britt Ekland and the girls from ABBA. And now it's the heat from the burning Volvos in the streets of Stockholm, Gothenburg, and Malmo. Typical day. Another typical day. France. Some guy goes and stabs four people. Don't worry, it was only four people. It was only four people, so it's already down the memory hole. Typical day in the United Kingdom, too. They put bollards around. After the last attack at the Houses of Parliament, they bollarded off the Houses of Parliament. So it looks ugly as hell now. A lot of London looks a lot uglier than it did a couple of years ago because there's bollards everywhere. It is the land of the bollards. It is the United Kingdom of bollards. And yet, nevertheless, some fella managed to get in his car and mow down 10 cyclists and pedestrians before hitting these bollards and coming. So he managed to get 10 cyclists and pedestrians before he hit the bollards. So we're going to need more bollards. In United Kingdom maternity wards, they should actually issue the baby with his own personal set of bollards before they let him leave the maternity ward. The bollardization of the Western world proceeds apace. And that's what you have, and that's relevant to the United States too, and to Canada and Australia. If you don't have a perimeter around the national border, because that's the easy way to do it. You know, you have a sovereign nation, and a sovereign nation generally used to, in the old days, back in the old days, used to have borders. And you could see it on maps. It's like property maps. It's like if you look at wherever you live in your town and you ask for the property maps, you'll see the boundary lines of your own property and your neighbor's property. And that's what nation states used to look like. And it'd be that's a very convenient place, the border, to have perimeter security. One big perimeter security around the national border. If you don't have that, as Britain hasn't, and as Sweden hasn't, and as France hasn't, then you end up having to have perimeters around everything inside the border. So you wind up like Britain, with these ugly bollards around everything. And it's no matter how many bollards you have, it's never enough. And as I said, that's relevant to the United States too. It's not just a question of terrorism, of course. It's also a question of free speech. Two other stories, and then we'll get on to your questions. Indonesia. A Chinese lady is looking at a year and a half in jail because she's been tried for blasphemy because she complained that the call to prayer at the local mosque was too loud. Have you ever lived near a mosque? Obama said it was the loveliest sound in the world or whatever. He loved hearing the call to prayer, the Adhan. Other people feel differently. It's like, well, it's like anything. You might like it the first time, but then it's like wake me up before you go-go or whatever. It drives you nuts by the 45th time you've heard it. And so this woman complained about it. She's a Chinese lady in Jakarta, in Indonesia, and she's looking at a year and a half in jail. And you can laugh at that, blasphemy trials. But my old pal Boris Johnson in London, he was Foreign Secretary till a couple of weeks ago, and he resigned over the Brexit thing. And he's now, he's now a backbencher. And he observed, he wrote a column saying he didn't agree with burqa bans, which are now coming in various countries and various parts of the world. But along the way, he said he didn't personally like burqas. They reminded him of letterboxes. That's what they have in Britain instead of the mailbox at the end of your drive like they have in the United States. They've got like a letterbox in the door. And the guy, it's like number 10 Downing Street. That has a letterbox in the door. And that's where they put the phone bill through for 10 Downing Street and the electric bill and all the rest of it. And he thinks a burqa is just like that. It's a big black thing with a letterbox slit in it. And he's quite right. And now it looks as if he's going to be forced to endure sensitivity training. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, is under pressure to send him off for sensitivity training because he said that women in burqas look like letterboxes. They do. I don't like to see women in burqas. It depresses me. Gothenburg, where they're burning all these cars in Sweden. I was in Gothenburg a couple of years ago. Having dinner with a friend of mine, she said she just didn't like to see all these burqas on the street. Depresses me too. I used to like it when you walk through the streets in Gothenburg and you saw leggy blonde Swedish women. Now you just see these body bagged women with these slits for letterboxes in the top of their heads. So I agree with Boris. But even though he was saying he didn't approve of a burqa ban, he's now apparently it's letterbox gate. He's got to go off to sensitivity training. And my point here is that the apostasy trial in Indonesia, where the blasphemy trial in Jakarta, where the woman is looking at a year and a half in jail, a Chinese woman complaining the Muslim call to prayer is too loud, and what's going on in London, where the blokey English bloke is made a remark about burkas, they're on the same continuum. And it's not a continuum anyone wants to be on. Anyway, that's some of what's been happening. I've been away a long time. As I was talking about with Tucker on the air, Tucker was away last week. And when you're away, it's like things that happened while you were away never really quite happened. So I understand that some judge on the Supreme Court's retiring and some other judge is being appointed to fill his place and whatever. But it's like when you're away, things that happen when you're away, it's like they never quite... Like if you were on the beach when the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot, it's like the whole Great War never really happened. Tucker and I were talking about this last night, so I'm still trying to play catch-up and get up to speed on some things. But we will start taking your questions right now. Nicola Timmerman wrote, do you think it is time, she writes from the Dominion of Canada, I do believe, do you think it is time for the opposition in Canada to push for a national holiday in February, as the Americans have, but to honour the fathers of Confederation? We seem to have less grasp of our history than Americans do, and this might help. I don't know on that last point, Nicola. I think most Western nations now, we have raised two generations to know nothing of their own history. And I think that's true generally in America. It's true in Canada. It's true in Europe. But that everybody, it's still sufficient of a novelty that everybody thinks, oh, we've got the problem. And Australia too, actually. I had a conversation with John Howard, the Aussie PM, about this about 10 years ago. Everybody thinks, oh, we don't know anything about history, not like those fellas over there. But I think generally we are living in an ahistorical age. I'm not sure a national holiday is the way to do it, because that generally just becomes, you know, another day for massive store-wide clearances and everything must go. So I don't necessarily think that's the way to do it. And I think there's actually no agreement. What the problem is that there's no agreement on what that history means. For example, in Victoria, British Columbia, they've now, the city hall has just mothballed its statue of Sir John A. Macdonald. For non-Canadian, nobody knows who outside Canada who Sir John A. Macdonald is, but he was the first Prime Minister of Canada. And he was a good prime minister. And in fact, Queen Victoria in particular liked him. But now, because he, I can't even remember what it is. What is it? Was it something to do with, I don't know. Was he on the wrong side of the transgender bathroom issue? Nobody knows. But the point is, he wasn't like a man of 2018, right? He used the wrong pronouns. He was not sound on same-sex marriage or whatever. Anyway, so Sir John A. Macdonald has got to go. They've got to mothball his statue. The city is called Victoria. Who do you think that's named after? That's the trouble. When you start with this stuff, I watched Rich Lowry, my old boss, on National Review, and he was talking about the Confederate General statue. And he said, well, you know, we're conservatives. We're not going to go to bat for Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. But you can bet when they start taking down the founding fathers that we're going to stand by that. We're going to object to that. They're taking down the statue of William McKinley in some California town. McKinley took a bullet for his country. He's dead. He's belongs to that select club of American presidents who wound up being carried out by the handles. And it's still not good enough for the left. Everything must go. So this thing in British Columbia, where they're taking down the statue of Sir John A. Macdonald in Victoria, sooner or later, they'll insist that Victoria has to be named Transgendered Bathroomville, or whatever it happens to be. It will all go. That's the point. That's the point. As I wrote yesterday, it's like that. There's a reason why the famous scene at the end of Planet of the Apes, the original movie, shows the shattered Statue of Liberty. Because the clearest, easiest visual shorthand for what happens when a civilization is destroyed is toppled statues. And the only difference in our age is that we are our own apes. Raj S. from Ontario, but he's actually in Germany at the moment, says, Mark, welcome back. While you're away, I embarked on a little sabbatical myself, which brought me back to Europe after a hiatus of 8 years. My stroll in a gentrified area centered around a lake was one of stark contrast. One group of people enjoying a nice evening in stylish cafes and restaurants that dotted a small promenade, enjoying lounge music and cosmopolitan food, while another group occupying most of the lakeshore spent the evening listening to fast-paced music and smoking hookers. What is happening in the most happening place of a Western European city? Is it gentrification or diversification? One of the interesting things is that people think that somehow cultural things are fixed, and they're not. They're as demographically dependent as anything else. So, for example, if you like a lively bar scene and your city Islamizes, there's not going to be a lively bar scene. And to take it away from a non-Islamic point, for example, in Vancouver, there's less theatre than there used to be because the city has become more Chinese. And oddly enough, a lot of Chinese people don't particularly want to go out and see a Noel Coward play or Terence Rattigan of an evening. So the things that we assume, and that applies generally. Everyone, oh, Canadians, they love their hockey. Well, you know, wait till Canada's semi-Muslim and see how much hockey there is around. Oh, you know, it's great to drive along in the car listening to classic rock from the 80s. Well, oddly enough, when you're like in Florida, for example, when your society Hispanicizes, Hispanics aren't that into classic rock from the 80s, so it's harder to find it on the radio. Cultural things, they lag a little, and it's true that, you know, for example, other cultures can pick up on certain trends. Like, for example, there's a lot of people in the UK and other parts of the Commonwealth who like Indian food, who like curries and like to go and have a big vindaloo and wash it down with 14 pints of lager on a Friday night. But generally speaking, cultural tastes are vulnerable to big shifts in demography. And that's why what we were talking about yesterday about the annexation of the public space, is important here. James actually had a thought on that removal of the statue of Sir John A. Macdonald from City Hall in Victoria. The mayor of Victoria, he reminds us that the mayor of Victoria, Lisa Help, said the statue was a reminder of colonial violence. Actually, your job is a reminder of colonial violence, Mayor Helps, because there would be no Victoria, there would be no British Columbia, and there would be no city for you to be mayor in without what you call colonial violence. There's something pathetic about a society so psychologically unhealthy that it wages war on its own past. Daniel Vaught writes, Hey Mark, on a lighter note, I've been wondering if you're an admirer of your fellow Canadian, Leon Redbone. He's obviously an admirer of the old standards and seems to perform them very well. As I understand it, he's something of a recluse, or at least highly idiosyncratic. So what do you think? I do like him. I like the way he does raw versions of old songs. And I think that's very appealing. I don't know whether he's a recluse. I met him, I mean, it's decades ago now. And I suppose if he was less of a recluse, I'd have been bumping him into him more often. But he was at one point out in the world. We'll try and get him on one of our little musical shows here and see if we can get him on. Andy writes, from Oprah to The Rock to the creepy porn lawyer, do you think we'll ever escape the age of celebrities mulling presidential bids? Well, look, Oprah, President Oprah, that's one thing. President The Rock, that's another thing. The creepy porn lawyer doesn't even meet the definition of celebrity. At best, he's the lawyer for a minor celebrity, which is Stormy Daniels. I was not personally familiar with Stormy's oeuvre until she sued the president. But I accept that if one is, it's a niche market. I gather, in fact, the bottom has dropped out of pornography so that you can't be a big time porn star anymore. It's not like Linda Lovelace in the 70s when it was playing at suburban shopping malls and it was dignified as erotica and middle class parents thought it was cool to go and see it. Like Deep Throat was where you see now the Emoji Movie or the Lego Batman movie or whatever, you know, Ant-Man 37. In the 70s, that is where Deep Throat would be playing and suburban parents would take Simon and Garfunkel off the 8-track and say, let's go and see Deep Throat tonight, darling. And so it was possible to be a huge big-time porn star. And the porn thing is collapsed now because basically it's like selfies. It's like blogs. It's like everybody does it themselves. So it's like porn in the old days. I might expand this into a book because I've got a whole kind of thesis here. But the point, I remember talking about my old friend Victor Lowndes, who was Hugh Hefner's number two at Playboy. And Victor Lowndes said to me, I asked him once about why there were not more foreign girls in Playboy. And he said to me, well, it's because the fantasy of Playboy for the American reader is that they want the girl next door, but she just happens to have no clothes on. That's the whole idea. But they want it to be like a girl you could meet if you happen to live at 27 Elm Street, and then you open up Playboy, but it's a girl who could theoretically be living at 29 Elm Street, but she just happens to have had all her clothes fall off. That was the whole thinking about Playboy. And of course, they weren't girls next door. They were professional models. But now they actually are the girl next door. If you want to see the girl at 29 Elm Street without her clothes on, just go on the internet. She'll be there. She'll almost certainly be there. So the whole porn industry has collapsed. So Stormy Daniels is barely a minor celebrity in that sense. And so it's not like Oprah running for president or The Rock running for president. We now have a minor celebrities lawyer running for president. And there are too many lawyers in America anyway. America has, as my old friend Conrad Black always says, America employs as many lawyers as the rest of the planet combined. And one of the problems is that leads to a highly ineffectually litigious society. So it might make America marginally more effective if more minor celebrities, minor lawyers were to run for president. So in that sense, the creepy porn lawyer running for president might actually be a good thing. Fizz Rad writes, glad to have you back, Mark. I see that the Las Vegas police have, quote, closed their investigation into the deadliest mass murder on American soil, not occurring on 9/11, without solving much of anything, at least that they're telling us. Any thoughts, insights? Well, I'll say this. I was in Las Vegas a couple of months ago, whatever it was. For one of these suits involving carry cats and CRTV. I can't remember which one it is. There's so many of them. In fact, actually, I was served with a new suit while I was there. He had one of his goons come up and serve me with a defamation suit while I was promenading through town. And in fact, I stayed on that building, not in the Mandalay Bay. They got another hotel that's on top of it. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me how these things happen. But there's like a hotel that's stacked up on top of the other hotel. But I was in that building. And it was interesting to me how psychologically the town has moved on. Everybody seems to understand that the Clark County Sheriff's Department, perhaps at the behest of the FBI, either bungled or gave the appearance of bungling the investigation. It's not all on them. Back in the guy's hometown, wherever it was he lived, his house was broken into and stuff stolen. This guy does the worst single shooter mass murder in American history, and they haven't even secured his house. And nobody knows why nobody knows anything about this thing, except that Las Vegas is a deeply corrupt town. And I have no idea how it is that you can perpetrate a crime on that scale and it just disappears. I mean, we began this show talking about somebody who stabs four people in France, forgotten. Some guy who mows down 10 cyclists and pedestrians in London, forgotten. But in this case, he piled up a huge mound of dead people. And it's almost as if it never happened. And that is deeply weird. Leslie B. writes, Mark, what are your thoughts about the Jewish lesbian actress who is apparently not gay enough for the social justice warriors and is now bounced from the Batwoman project and has quit Twitter? How does lesbian Jew figure in the hierarchy of identity politics? If she were a Muslim lesbian, would that have been better? I know that Irshad Manji is a Muslim lesbian, and she is an absolutely terrible time. I don't think that's a great. I don't think it's a great idea to be a Muslim lesbian. It's you have to be pretty tough to stand up to anything everything they throw at you. I do think being a Jew now doesn't count in the hierarchy of identity politics. Which is one reason, simply because Islam comes so high up the chart. And you see that obviously in things like the British Labour Party, which is basically ever... I mean, we had a thing... There's a thing, controversy over in London, where Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the British Labour Party, it's called Wreathgate, because he was seen to be laying a wreath for one of the perpetrators of the Munich massacre of Israeli Olympic athletes in 1972. Now, at a certain level, that's insane that the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition is laying a wreath for a terrorist. And he's given stupid and contradictory answers that he was at the wreath-laying ceremony and the wreath may have been in his hand and his arm may actually have been the arm that lowered the wreath to the ground, but he wouldn't actually agree that that is what you might call laying a wreath for somebody. So he's giving stupid answers. But again, it comes back to the demography. It comes back to the fact that Jews are an aging and dwindling percentage of the British population, and that Muslims are a surging, rising element of that population, and whatever you feel about them, to put it at its mildest, entirely antipathetic to Jews, and a significant number of them loathe and hate Jews. So if you believe in democracy and you believe in maintaining your electoral viability, then being as anti-Semitic as Jeremy Corbyn is actually a rational position to hold from his point of view. From his point of view, he depends on Labour votes. And that means that in almost every city down the spine of England, he depends on Muslim votes. That's simply as a mass phenomenon, and it has a trickle down effect in that it diminishes Jewishness as an identity throughout. Now the official Jews, as my friend Ezra Levant likes to call them, don't get this. They're still into the multi faith outreach and all the rest of it, and they don't realize the ground is shifting even as they speak, and they are becoming irrelevant. So all the things they like, to be a member of at the head of a big Jewish group and to be invited to lunch with the Prime Minister or whatever, all that is going to go. Because in the end, if you want to retain electoral viability in a democratic society, then demography spells everything out. There's an additional thing with Twitter, though, which I think... I mean, I pay no attention to Twitter. I said this, if you've seen the speech I gave when I picked up the George Jonas Award, I think Twitter is complete rubbish. I think it's a form of Chinese whispers that exists mainly to drive minor celebrities to commit suicide. And I've mentioned before the young lady... lady's hardly the word, but she was 22 or 23, from somewhere in the Canadian Maritimes, and she wound up in Los Angeles working in the porn industry. And I certainly wouldn't wish that for my own daughter or for anybody's daughter. And she tweeted that she didn't like to do scenes with gay men because she was a bit worried about health issues. And immediately everybody said, that's totally homophobic. And 2 days later, she killed herself. And the guy who drove her to kill herself, this malignant gay, which is a type. I saw one on stage in a nightclub a few days ago in New York. Used to see more of them. The sort of like the kind of very openly malignant kind of gleefully malignant kind. Anyway, this guy was gloating on the internet that he'd driven her to kill herself, and he said good riddance. And that's what they want. The Roseanne story was kind of okay, but it would have been much more satisfying, wouldn't it, if Roseanne had actually killed herself. That'd be great. That would be great. Do you remember when they were beating up Steve Martin and Paul Simon because they described Carrie Fisher as a lovely girl? Now, these are guys who knew. You know, Paul Simon was married to Carrie Fisher. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. The fact that you know her doesn't excuse you. So they're beating up on these guys who are mourning. Paul Simon is mourning his deceased former bride. And they don't get this. You shouldn't have said girl. Paul Simon said, go, we're going to get rid of him. It would have been great. Wouldn't it have been great if they'd driven Paul Simon to commit suicide? Walk away. If you're on Twitter and someone tweets something, tries to get a Twitter storm against you, go for a walk in the wood. Twitter's rubbish, complete rubbish. It's Chinese whispers to drive minor celebrities to commit suicide. Pay no attention to it. Let's see, what else we got? Oh, there's Glenn Flint. Says, hi, Mark, welcome back. In your absence, I've been adding to my wardrobe in an effort to maintain the high standards you've set for the club. I recently added a dress bow tie with matching pocket squares and suspenders. My wife refuses to be seen in public with me in that attire. Is there something I'm missing here? Are bow ties the mark of a true nerd like Bill Nye, the science guy? I've never seen you sporting a bow tie. And now I'm second-guessing myself. Please let me know. All the best, Glenn Flint. This is one of the most fascinating sentences I've ever seen. I recently added a dress bow tie with matching pocket square and suspenders. Are you telling me, Glenn, that the bow tie and the pocket square and the suspenders all match? Because that's fantastic. I didn't even know you could get that out there. What is it? Is it all red with white polka dots or whatever? I've never seen that. Never seen that. My general rule is you should never have a matching tie and handkerchief. And I say that, I don't know whether that's something Bo Brummel or whoever would have agreed with. I've always observed that. Well, there used to be do you remember when they introduced barcodes? And barcodes came in, you remember the famous thing of the first President Bush being unfamiliar with what a barcode scanner was. And I remember going in to some store somewhere once, and as like a novelty item, it had matching tie and handkerchief, and it was like a barcode tie with a barcode pocket square. And I thought that was a very funny joke, but one of the collateral effects of that joke was that ever since I've never worn a matching tie and handkerchief. I think a bow tie is hard to pull off. And Tucker, my friend Tucker Carlson, he wore a bow tie at one point, and that became a thing. It's like that, what's that sitcom, the Larry David sitcom, whatever that's called. There's a scene where Larry David, there's an episode where Larry David starts wearing a bow tie, and they all complain that he's turned into Tucker Carlson. I mean, it became a thing. Or George Will. Favoured a bow tie, so that a bow tie became a conservative thing, and so I worry about that because you never want to play to caricature, and I worry about that. But at the same time, I'm not really happy. I think on television, particularly men, particularly conservative men, should wear ties. I don't really agree with this thing where you see it's like becoming common now, where you see guys, open neck guys on TV. I wore an open neck shirt for lunch. I mentioned John Howard, the Australian Prime Minister. A couple of years ago, I wore an open neck shirt for lunch with John Howard in Sydney. And the reason I did that is because on Australian TV, all the guys are open necked. I'm usually the only guy in a tie there. And so I thought, I was fed up feeling out of place. So I thought, oh, I'm having lunch with John Howard, so I'll go open neck. Well, of course, he had a tie, and he berated me for it. And he was quite right. He was quite right to do that. You know? It's a walk down the street. Walk down the street of your town. And think how it would appear if a guy from, say, 1958 or 1937 or 1912 were to suddenly reappear on his old main street and look at what people are wearing today. He'd think we were in a land of overgrown children. And he wouldn't. And so John Howard was quite right to call me out for being open-necked. Kathy Sheedel. Oh, my! I might say, it's lots of weird things. I'm getting a bit croaky here. Lots of weird things have happened while I was away. And one of the terrible things is that all my the internet is becoming so bloody boring, in part because of Twitter is just hysterical. Racist! Racist! Transphobe! That's just nuts. And so they're just egging you on to kill yourself. And then Facebook is a complete bore. And I missed the internet of a decade ago. And I was very sad when I came back from my sojourn overseas and found that two of my favorite bloggers, Kathy Sheedel, my fellow Canadians too, Kathy Sheedel and Laura Rosenkahn, had given up blogging, more or less. And I miss them. And the internet is becoming more boring than it was. And I regret that. And we will try and do our best not to... not to add a third stricken Canadian to the mound of corpses piling up in the blogger crematorium of the Canadian internet. But Kathy Sheedel, who did a terrific job filling in for me on our Saturday night movie column and did some terrific columns on Bette Davis and Psycho and all kinds of things, says, will we ever see a PM Boris Johnson? And I don't know about. And I always say this is like whatever it is now. 20 years ago at the Spectator, we used to have these rather convivial lunches once a week. And I'm sitting there at lunch, and Boris comes in about 15 minutes late, and he goes, "I'm sorry, I'm so late, but I just had this amazing epiphany. I realized that in 20 years' time, I'm going to be Prime Minister." And I'm slightly astonished. We all fell around laughing. So I was slightly astonished when 15, 16, 17 years later, it looked as if it might actually be a possibility. Now, I think he's a bit of an opportunist. I don't think he's particularly anchored in any coherent political philosophy. I think he has the common touch. I think he has a certain Teflon quality that he shares with Donald Trump that is always useful. He was not a particularly good minister of the crown, as I understand it from people working in the Foreign Office, in that he didn't. I think actually the Attorney General of Anguilla, after the hurricane struck a few months ago, last year, he said Boris Johnson is the worst foreign secretary we've ever had. That's the view from the Caribbean of Boris. But you know something? You need... what's happened with Brexit in Theresa May's hands, where she has basically tried to strip Brexit of meaning, to have a Brexit that is so denuded of content as to be utterly meaningless. To reverse that and to get a real meaningful Brexit across the line, I think will require someone who, whether he does it for opportunist reasons or whether he does it for coherent philosophical reasons, has a kind of a size to him. And if Boris did want to make a move, Boris did this book about Churchill. What was it called? Churchill on Leadership, I thought. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, normally you're supposed to have to subtly decode what politicians are trying to tell you. In this case, Boris just said, I'm Churchill. I'm the Churchill de Nogeur. Like Churchill, I'm despised by my party. I'm loathed by my party. My party doesn't trust me. But I'm a great man who bestrides the world as a colossus. So eventually my party will have no choice but to turn to me. And most politicians, as I said, when they write their silly little books or whatever, you have to decode what it is they're trying to say. Boris just spells it out. I'm Winston. Vote for me. And I don't know whether that's going to work. But right now, what they're trying to do with Brexit, I cannot tell you the contempt in which I hold Theresa May for what I think was a conscious undermining and hollowing out of Brexit. I've been consistent about Theresa May for 20 years, since I think I wrote about her in The Telegraph in 1998, literally 20 years. David Watson writes, isn't sensitivity training what we used to call re-education camps? Absolutely. It is what it is. And if they do send Boris to sensitivity training, I hope he breaks the machine. Because everybody goes to sensitivity training. My old friend, the novelist, Sebastian Foulkes, he said something rather careless about the Koran. They thought it was an absolutely dreadful book. And they made him go to sensitivity training. And he came out from sensitivity training with the usual glassy-eyed says, oh, Koran, marvelous book. Islam made a splendid contribution to civilization. Everything you can think of was invented by Muslim. Yeah. I'd love it. If there's a chance of getting through sensitivity training, Boris will break the machine. I hope that happens. I don't want him to come out with the same glassy-eyed stare as everybody else. James Driscoll writes, of the many hypocrisies of the left, the fundamental one is Darwin's survival of the fittest, which is their religion, but which they conveniently ignore in all policy proposals requiring that unfortunates be provided to by the fortunate. The preservation of the idle, the hopeless, the helpless, and the weak ultimately destroys the society. Can you explain why they don't understand this? I have my thoughts on it, primarily that humans are an evil scourge on the planet, but would prefer to hear yours. Well, that's true. But you're right that one of the reasons for being a Darwinian is that survival of the fittest prevails, so that if there are dysfunctional elements and groups within society, their dysfunction leads them to a diminished and irrelevant state and eventually to extinction. So you don't have to worry about them anymore. But in our age, the uselessness of a person is often inversely proportionate to their value in virtue signaling terms. You see, that's why, for example, for people like Jeremy Corbyn, the Palestinians are the house pets of the left because they are totally useless. They have all the useful people in the Palestinian territories the last seven decades have all got out, and they're, you know, you meet them around the world. They're doctors in Paris or they're lawyers in London or whatever. You run into all the useful people got out. And what's left are the most pitiful, helpless, dysfunctional, useless people. And for that very reason, they're venerated as the house pets of the left. And that's what's fascinating to me about this general thesis, James, because this idea of the uselessness of saying, oh, you know, these people can't do anything, so let's just increase their welfare checks and they can sort of sit around watching the television all day. That used to just be applied to a small percentage of society. And what's interesting, particularly if you talk to big tech people or people who think about the next big idea, these people who say, for example, that 30% of people who have a job right now are going to be unemployed by the year 2030, that by that point, automation will have rendered 30% of all existing jobs obsolete. So that we're all going to be. What was you said? What were the words you said? The preservation of the idle, the hopeless, the helpless, the weak. So that throughout Western society and in the world as a whole, maybe 2 to 3 billion people are going to be idle, hopeless, helpless, and weak. And this is their blueprint for society. When you talk to the high-tech guys, their idea is everybody should have an automatic living wage. They won't have to work for the wage because there'll be no work. But we will find some way to give them some money, and we accept that it's going to be hard to keep them off the heroin and the meth. But we're going to do our best to design some little gizmo so they can listen to Miley Cyrus while they're doing their heroin or whatever. And they will have a living wage and they will just lie around the house being idle, hopeless, helpless, and weak, as James puts it, while the ever smaller number of people who are required to do anything will be an ever more ingenious elite isolated from these people. I don't think that's going to work out. Helena Papadopoulos writes, have you read yet about the strange story about the gay female professor from NYU who is the latest target of the Me Too movement with accusations of harassment leveled against her by her former gay male student? Feminists do not seem to be thrilled about this. What's next? I haven't actually read about this story, but I will say that one thing I encountered in a modest way while I was on my break is the sense of increasing disconnect that lesbians feel from the LGBTQ, whatever it is, community. Because lesbians, there's a strain of lesbianism that regards itself as the principal victim of the rise of transgenderism. And you see it, for example, when now that the vagina monologues is becoming unperformable at American campuses because it implies that to be a woman you have to have a vagina. And, of course, there are a lot of, as we see when these cases, I think I mentioned one on Rush. I can't remember what that case was about. Oh, yeah, it was some woman who'd been stuck in a homeless shelter and she'd found herself having to share a room with another woman and the other woman happened to have a penis. So this woman is, like, walking around getting ready for bed at night and she's taking off her bra and then she takes off her panties and she's, like, swaggering around in her stockings with the old meat and two veg swinging between her legs. And the other woman who doesn't have a penis, she's one of this dwindling number of women who does not have a penis. There's like 7 or 8 of them still in Toronto, I believe. And so she feels uncomfortable. And so she goes to the human right because she was sexually abused. So she associates the penis. She's old school. Old school feminist. She associates the penis with phallocentric domination. And she doesn't realize it's just like a perfectly normal woman's accessory now. So she's shocked at this and because it's traumatizing her. So she goes to the Human Rights Tribunal in Ontario and they say, no, you're the hater. What's up with you? It's perfectly normal for a woman to have a penis. Get a grip on yourself. And there's a strain of lesbianism. And I keep talking about, I must stop using that phrase, the strain of lesbianism. I think it was a concept album in the 70s. Anyway, the strain of lesbianism that is arguing that all this this war on cisgender categorization is just phallocentric domination by the back door. I think I got that right. Anyway, I don't have a dog in that fight. So we'll see how that all shakes out, as we say. Lawrence Brennan writes, the media constantly refer to Heather Hewer, who was killed last year at Charlottesville, when anyone criticizes Antifa. Yet they trivialize or ignore completely the numerous video of people beaten by Antifa and their ilk. I wonder how much the average American even knows of these incidents. That last line is extremely interesting to me, Lawrence, because what is interesting is what we choose to commemorate. So this Charlottesville thing, which we've just been seeing the first anniversary observances of, we're going to be seeing that. Next year there'll be second anniversary, there'll be fifth anniversary, then be 10th anniversary. It's become a thing. Nobody commemorates the first anniversary of, say, Steve Scalise and his congressional colleagues getting shot. Steve Scalise was targeted for political assassination. In the Charlottesville thing, the reason there was violence was because the authorities abandoned their duty. It's absolutely disgraceful what they did. They decided they wanted the so-called alt-right to get the hiding of their lives. And so they basically backed away and drove the two groups into conflict just for a laugh, just for their own amusement. And somebody died in part because of it. Now, whether somebody will eventually, I mean, as far as I understand, this guy has a pretty good case that, for a start, whether this guy is entirely mentally competent is an issue, and the idea he's surrounded by people on all sides because the police have abandoned the streets, and he's panicking, and he's daffy, and he's not particularly, I mean, you know, we'll see what happens to that if it ever gets to a jury. But there is no doubt. That has not yet been decided, but there is no doubt that Steve Scalise and his colleagues were targeted for political assassination. And yet that anniversary is not worthy of being memorialized. And everybody's forgotten that. That doesn't count. We're going somewhere very dark. And to reiterate the point I made to Tucker, all these stupid people who talk about no platforming, the people, for example, at Middlebury, a female professor, she's not right wing, she's basically a liberal professor, and she invited Charles Murray to take part in a discussion. You can't have that anymore. There's a correct view, and you can't say anything that isn't the correct view. That's what we see everywhere. Doesn't matter whether it's Boris and the burqa or what's going on at Middlebury. And so when the mob decides that there cannot be a debate, and they want violence, they put this woman, this liberal professor, in hospital. And they paid no price for it. And there will be more of that. And she just got a concussion. But maybe next time they'll kill her. Because if you think about it, wouldn't it be good to kill one of these? Like, particularly a liberal professor who makes the mistake of inviting, you know, Charles Murray or Ann Coulter to give a speech. And yes, it would be sad if you killed them, but it actually would send a good message, wouldn't it? That, that's what happens when you want to have debate, when you want to have argument, when you want to have a vigorous exchange of ideas. So maybe if you don't want to be killed, you'll just keep your head down and discuss everything with the permitted boundaries. And we're seeing more and more and more of that. Lawrence Brennan also says, by the way, I just finished a 5,000-mile, 3-week train trip to New York, Boston, Chicago, and Kansas City. I wore a bow tie every day, as well as a straw boater. I've worn them since I was 16, and I get nothing but compliments. That's the boater, Lawrence. I had to wear a boater. This is how far back I go. That's like summer school uniform. I love a boater. If you wear a straw boater, you should come on the Mark Steyn Club cruise, and we'll both wear our boaters and we'll sing while strolling through the park one day in the merry, merry month of May. There's nothing better. Nothing better. That's what you want. I'm all for boaters. Boris is burqa-phobic, but I will never be boater-phobic. I love straw boaters. Thank you. Thank you for that. Brandy Edwards. Brandy. Oh, by the way, before I think this is the first time we've ever had a Brandy on the show. I was driving along today. I've only been back in the country a week. And I notice on the old satellite radio that there's all these new channels. So I've got this like Yacht Rock thing. And if you remember our Nonstop Number One special, where I played, we had old, I dusted off some of my old disc jockey interviews. And so we had my old chums from Bananarama and Andy Williams and Julio Iglesias. And we had Christopher Cross there, and he was singing Sailing. And I said it used to be a genre, and they called it Yacht Rock. And I get back to the country, and I discovered that Sirius Satellite Radio has now introduced this channel called Yacht Rock. I say, oh, that's great. It's funny that I just mentioned Yacht Rock just the other day, and now they've got a Yacht Rock station. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to hearing Summer Breeze Makes Me Feel Fine, Blowing Through the Jasmine in My Mind, and all that kind of stuff. And it's like everything on these satellite radio channels. They've only got 20 records. So you hear, and this is why I mention it, Brandy Edwards, you hear Brandy, You're a Fine Girl every 15 minutes. What's the point of starting all these radio stations that have only got 20 records? One of the first shows I ever did in the middle of nowhere was like a 6-hour overnight show. And I had more than 20 records back then. When I was a teenage disc jockey, I didn't just play the same 20 records over and over. And no disrespect to Brandy Edwards, but I don't want to hear it. It's like, well, the first time I hear Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, I hadn't heard it in like, 28 years. I thought, oh, great, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. I sing along. And then I switch it on again. It's still Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. So I don't understand the point of starting all these stations and they only have 20 records for each station. And I got 4,000 radio stations that all of them just have 20 records. Completely pointless. Anyway, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. What do you want to talk about? Oh, yeah, here we are. Hi, Mark. This is totally off the political subjects. Remember a few months ago when that poor dog died on a plane after they made the owner put it in the overhead bin? You talked about it very passionately with Tucker Carlson, asking how a group of free-born people didn't get up and let the dog out. My feelings exactly. You also mentioned that your beloved dog was very ill and you were working so hard to save your dear pup. Being in the same situation myself with my sweet 14-year-old Basset Hound Maggie, I was just wondering how your dog was doing. I hope better. Yes, indeed, actually, Brandy. I've got one of the... I hope your Basset Hound is doing great. I've got one of those dogs who's got, like, everything wrong with them and is somehow indestructible. And is like has had some very bad... Actually, the darkest hour of the CRTV business, when we got into trouble with those bums, that's just fair, because they listen to this show, the CRTV lawyers. In fact, I think CRTV's lawyers make up something like 47% of the audience for this show, because they're monitoring us all the time. So this is a shout out for you guys. Anyway, that was at the beginning of the CRTV troubles. The poor old dog was sick, and I wound up taking the dog to Tufts in Massachusetts, and I was accused there when we launched the club. Some crazy kooky person accused me of using club subscriptions to launder money into my veterinarian bills. And that's not actually true. But even if it were true, I wouldn't care, because that's how much I love that dog. And that dog has been to Tufts and has been to Pennsylvania and has had great treatment at a clinic in Montreal, which is actually because I'm in, 20 minutes south of the border, that's actually the nearest specialist is this one in Montreal. My advice for you, Brandy, is if you're ever in Canada, for God's sake, don't go near the hospitals. You don't want to go to any of the human hospitals. But if you get a problem, if you're visiting Montreal and get a little bit of a problem, go to the veterinarian clinic, because they're absolutely excellent. But thank you for your kind wishes for my dog, and I wish you the same. Christine, I was not going to take a question. What Christine Dewey says, wondering what do you think about Omarosa? Amarosa? Is this the way to Amorosa? Do they play that on Yacht Rock? Wondering what you think about Amorosa stabbing Trump in the back. Why wouldn't she be honored and happy being a part of the president's staff? And as such, supporting him. Is she really on the Democrat side? Well, she's the one who's been recording everybody. and then revealing these recordings to the world. I mean, it sounds to me as if she was basically recording all these people from her first day in the White House. She's, I've no real clue as to who she is or why she was so indispensable that President Trump decided to put her in the White House. What I liked about President Trump... is that when you go to normal political rallies and you're like backstage and you're meeting the candidate or whatever, and you say to the guy, you're in the room, there's like six or seven of you in the room, and you're waiting to talk to the candidate, and you say to the guy, well, what do you do? And he goes, oh, I'm the candidate's staffer who deals with foreign policy issues or whatever. They're the only people in the, you know, the usual staffer dweebs that hang around politicians. And when you were at a Trump rally and you'd be waiting to shake hands with the candidate and you'd say to the guy you were standing next to, what do you do? And he'd say, oh, I won series 12 of The Apprentice. It was all people like that. There were no staffers. There was only Hope Hicks and Corey Lewandowski. And otherwise he had no staffers and there were just like a few semi-finalists from The Apprentice and whatever that were there in the room with him. And I enjoyed that. I don't know whether it was necessary to put those people in the White House, and it certainly wasn't necessary in this particular case. But I think that's just adds to the gaiety of nations, and I mean, I feel for her in the same way as I feel about Stormy Daniels. I don't think anyone's going to buy her book because she's abandoned the right, so she's killed off 50% of the potential readership there. And on the left regards her as a useful cudgel with which to clobber the president, but not enough to the point where they want to buy her book. So when you do those, when that's the trouble when you start selling out your own side. You often sell out your own side, and nobody on the other side picks up the slack. And that's the situation that she is in. I thank you for your questions. We've gone on a little later today because we started late. I'm all super croaky. And I'm going to go off. By the way, the other thing, we didn't get to this. The appalling taste of Theraflu. I can't stand it. I usually smuggle in, if I'm in Australia or I'm in Britain or I'm in Bermuda, I usually smuggle in a little bit of Lemsip because I quite like those. Ever since they changed the formula for Theraflu, I've always liked to smuggle in illegal Lemsip and get high on that. And I forgot to do it this time. So I've had Theraflu and it's a real, whatever they've done to it, it is a real total stinker what they made it. That is the critical issue facing America today. What the hell have they done to Theraflu? But we'll have to save that one for next time. Thank you for all your questions. Don't forget, you can put them to us live when we do a Clubland Q&A live on the inaugural Mark Steyn Club Cruise. Sailing from, where are we sailing from in Montreal? Is it the King Edward Dock? That's where all the, is it the big old King Edward VII Dock down there in Montreal? We'll be sailing there, and then we come in somewhere in Boston. Where do we come in Boston? What's the big dock in Boston? I don't know. It's probably not the King Edward Dock, is it? They probably changed the name of it. Anyway. If you go to steinonline.com, click on our cruise button. We'd love to see you on the cruise. We'll be there with Michelle Backman and Faleem McAleer and Anne McElhinney and Tal Backman. We'll be doing like a little Song of the Week thing live and we'll have a grand old time. So come and see us and we will see you next time on our Clubland Q&A.